I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Severin, this is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers, and today I'm talking to Nels Veliquet. I love your name. It's like a rock star name, and Nels has got some different roles, but among them is that he's a mead maker. And welcome to the show, Nels.
Thanks, Severin. Thank you very much.
Do you want to give yourself a little introduction for our listeners, what you're up to, and maybe just a short introduction to what is mead?
Yeah. Mead is one of the oldest alcoholic beverages, and you'll see it much more now penetrating the craft beverage scene as cider has gained a lot of popularity recently. Of course, sort of on the backs of the craft beer movement that's been going on for about 15 years in the U.S. And essentially what it is it's honey with water and yeast added, and bang, there's your mead. Now you can put just about anything that you want into it, spices or fruits. So it really lends itself to an experimental sort of nature, I suppose. And it is something that you'll probably see more and more of just because it hasn't been around for a while. But there are several really good producers of it across the country, whether you live on the West Coast, the East Coast, or in the Midwest, and it's just been a passion of mine for about 20-some-odd years, since that's actually what got me into keeping bees.
So just to review, mead is a fermentation. It's a fermented product, and I think it's traditional in Ethiopian cuisine. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Pretty much every culture around the world has some sort of affiliation with a honey-based fermented beverage. Ethiopia has an actual commercial production right now, and their traditional beverage is called tej. Pretty much anywhere in the world that there have been people or bees, which pretty much means anywhere, people have figured out that even just adding a little bit of water to it and leaving it out turns it into something that gives them pleasure. So it is a really interesting historical beverage, and what I've noticed over the years, especially being a beekeeper as well, is that people are fascinated with the relationship with bees, and people are really interested in the history of their beverages. We see a lot of that now in the craft movement, and most of that is just, you know, understanding and being closer to the product. And that's not exclusive, obviously, to beverages. That's one of the reasons why we see so many people interested in different types of foods and animal husbandry these days as well.
So compared to, say, beer or wine, how long of a fermentation period does the meat undergo?
It's more like wine. And in the U.S., if you want a commercial production license, that's the type of license that you would get, would be a winemaking license. It's typically a 6 month to 1 year project, depending on how strong you'd like to make it. There are some mead makers that are experimenting with faster forms of fermentation, trying to get it closer to a beer or a cider where they can turn it around within 1 month. But that's sort of the ongoing edge of the research. Most of the time, it's a wine-style product.
So you got into making mead, and then you got into keeping bees, and it sounds like you're having some strategy aspect to your life. Is that a related emergence, or what is the connection there?
I don't know if I would go so far as to say that I have any sort of plan, and I certainly would not recommend that to anyone who might be listening today, because the world is an ever-changing place, and you know, for me, it really has been a labor of love. I started doing it when I was young because I was interested in how alcohol was formed, and I was a history buff. And it really drew me, I needed honey, so it drew me into more of the bees. I grew up in a very large fruit-growing operation with a lot of cherries, and so I was familiar with bees, and we used bees for pollination, but it had always been peripheral to me. It had not been something that I was particularly interested in. So just like a lot of things, as my interest in the mead developed and my interest in bees developed and my interest in just general apiary husbandry, you know, the tending of the bees pushed me into more and more contact with other people that wanted to know about bees to add to beer, wanted to know about bees on their cider farms. And so as that aspect of my personal life, you know, my own hobby, I became more and more knowledgeable about the stuff that I had learned through business, either through practical experience like marketing or logistics, and my practical education at the school with finance and administration. I really began to, you know, what I saw were people starting these new businesses, and like most passionate people, and I have dallied very closely many times with professionalizing my hobby. That's what people do, whether it's knowing how to smoke a ham or knowing how to grow asparagus or knowing how to make beer. Generally, creative class people, they have a passion, and that's what they know how to do. But today, the business environment is such that you really have to be multifaceted in your skill set, or you have to have mentors, you have to have people that are willing to help you with that. So I had a lot of acquaintances and friends that were getting into these kind of businesses, and through my practical work experience, I had a lot of government and bureaucratic interface experience, and I've, again, through just professional hard knocks, found out how to deal with getting a permit, how to deal with your local zoning boards. And what I discovered sitting through endless hours of meetings and committees and things like that was that there is definitely a way to navigate that system, and that there was value in being able to translate my experience for other people. Because what I saw a few times was that the first one that I really noticed on was a friend wanted to start a bakery and was talking about the concessions that were being asked by their local zoning board for a lot of things that they really weren't that interested in, like parking spaces and semi-permeable surfaces and all the stuff that comes up as a business owner, just getting the physical space ready. And I just said, you know, that sounds really weird, because I was just working in this similar municipality, and I don't think what they're telling you is correct, which was a shock to my friend, who said, "Well, how could they know? How could they not know what the rules are?" And I guess this is one of those practical pieces of advice I would dispense in the interview, which is, don't ever assume that the people that are asking you to prove your concept even know their own rules. It's worth reading up on whatever it is that you're looking to do, whether it's a permit to produce alcohol, a permit to put up a building, or what the local land regulations are, because it's not something that you normally think about, but it is something that can definitely take time away from your creative energy that goes into your business.
So what you're saying is don't go to the meeting not knowing what your rights are.
Exactly. Be informed. And you either do that through the use of a consultant, which is sort of, that was the long way for me to talk about how I started becoming a agricultural or value-added consultant, which I would not recommend. It's not a steady paycheck, but it is a very interesting and engaging work that I do because, yeah, you have to know it, or you have to be willing, and I guess this is my other piece of advice, you have to be willing to go to people that know more than you do, and whether or not you take their advice or leave it, at least you have it for perspective in hindsight. You know, you can always say later, wow, I really should have listened to Nels, or man, I'm glad I didn't listen to Nels. But it's definitely worth, you know, getting insight from people that have experience. And I think it's been a valuable service, and it makes a big difference when you go in and you understand what the rules are when you start to play.
Well, another thing to consider for the new entrepreneurs is that there's often retired business people who, especially in, you know, foodie types of places, have many relevant skills that could be useful, and that building a board of advisors and collaborators in your startup phase can be helpful not only in terms of social support and moral support and specific skill sets, but also, you know, useful in terms of vetting investors and vetting business plans. And that one of the things I learned from this business incubation session I went to was that businesses that go through the process of building their kind of micro support team early are best able to accommodate and do well with investment capital.
Yeah, I would agree, and it's, you know, the flip side to that is I've also learned over the years, you don't give away all your best ideas, and when you put together that network, you know, it's going to be a group of people that you're either naturally drawn to, you know, that you've been connected with through your own network and that you trust, I don't like to tie those two things together, but it's worth knowing, you know, that over the years I have probably had looser lips than I should have, and I can say from direct experience that I have seen things that I talked about doing or ideas that I had that I sort of shared freely show up on other people's shelves and become other people's methods for marketing. So I think when you start up new, you have to understand that you know what you're doing, and you have a good idea and a clear goal for where you want to go. Most other people will not have that same sort of clarity about your vision. And so I guess I'll circle back around to the municipal side of things. Even if you come up with the most perfect plan that has ticked off every box that is important on the list, and you leave the local board with nothing to suggest, they will find something to suggest. That's kind of what they're there to do. So I would, the classic example would be, you know, leave the painting slightly unfinished, but not in a major way, but so that someone can point out and say, hey, well, what about this here? And then you have the opportunity to respond back and say, that's a great idea. You know, thanks for pointing that out to us. It is definitely a dance, and there is a little bit of an art to it, but I would say you know, don't always come up with the most perfect plan, because the job of most agencies is to hammer on it and to modify it in some way. Other than that, make sure that you have that support network that you need.
The support network. So, well, it's a question whether we want to talk more about startup farm businesses or whether we want to talk more about Mead. It feels like Mead is pretty compelling right now. I've been reading here on your wonderful Facebook page where it seems like you're like the Mead hound of the West.
Well,
you've been writing about how the Nordic peoples were using Mead as a kind of an antibiotic.
Oh, yeah. Honey, I guess it goes, for me, it starts with the bees and the honey. You know, honey's been used for a long time. There are a lot of medicinal qualities about it. And more that people sort of go back and rediscover, and this is what we're seeing in cider apples, specific varieties being cultivated. You know, honey is much the same way. And it's like I said, it's always been a fun passion project. What I've tried to do over the years is give people information about it so that the larger business of mead can grow. And there have been, you know, some of the oldest mead makers, you know, I don't want to say the oldest, but some of the most established mead makers in North America now are, you know, about 20 years old. Most of the ones that are out there now are probably 5 years or less. So it's definitely one of those areas that I've always felt has had space within the craft beverage market. And I think it's just going to continue to grow like cider and craft beer. When you get right down to it, people want to have a connection with their product. They want to feel like they're involved in some way. And bees and human beings have been interacting with each other. You know, you can posit however you want, at least let's say a million years. You know, they were one of the first creatures that we figured out to follow and steal their food. So we've been connected to them for a long time, and people have this sort of innate, I think there's something genetically about it, an innate fascination with bees and a connection to them. You know, they may be terrified of them, and I often sort of joke, you know, the bees they're like your great aunt. Everybody wants to know how they're doing. As soon as they find out that you're a beekeeper, if you know anything about bees or honey, well, how are those bees doing? You know, I heard they were having a tough time, you know, a couple of years ago. Are they still okay? You know, is the world going to end? Einstein says the world's going to end if all the bees are gone. But which is great, because from a popular culture perspective, bees are always in vogue. The reality is that bees can turn their gene pool over way quicker than we can, and it is sort of that folly of humanity that we like to believe that there are things that we can do that will upset the whole balance of nature. But nature is pretty resilient and pretty smart and pretty tough. The bees will continue to be around, and they may not be all the same European bees that are so easy for us to handle, but there will be tough bees around indefinitely. So
well,
what else can
so
I tell
one
you
of the things
about,
I read on your blog was that the White House has got an initiative on Save the Bees, and apparently,
yes,
according to other environmental groups, it's kind of pathetic. I mean, one thing we've known is that the White House has been, you know, when they promoted their organic garden, they got super flack from the pesticide industry for promoting organic practices on the White House. And there was an interesting and kind of convoluted argument that if people didn't use chemicals, then the vegetables wouldn't grow and people would get cancer from not eating vegetables. Anyway,
there's a lot of circular logic.
The chemical industry mindset.
Yeah, and there's a lot of circular logic that gets utilized, I think, in both sides of marketing. You know, ultimately, if we're talking specifically about bees, it is there are a lot of efforts that are being made to help find methods of however we want to call it, natural beekeeping. I was always a natural beekeeper, mostly because I'm fairly lazy.
And it is different when you get into a commercial realm and you get serious outbreaks of varroa, or you get nosema, or some of these other really nasty pests and
what's
viruses.
What's the one called brood blast?
The foul brood. Yeah, that one's very creepy. It's very alien-like, where they impregnate the brood of the bees with the mite that grows inside them and kills them. So they're open to a lot of different, I would say, my science would say, a multivariate set of external pressures, but the bees do figure out a way to handle it. Where you really come into the issue is when you try to keep, when your business is about keeping 10,000 hives of bees healthy. It's just like trying to keep 10,000 head of cattle healthy. You have to look at different methodologies in order to make that system work. And, you know, from one end to the other, the colony collapse disorder is something that has been, you know, it comes around every few years, and it is something that the industry has continued to manage over the years, but it's still something that's not completely diagnosed. So it's with the bees, it often comes back to, unless you can specifically target, you can target, like, here I had a mite infection, you know, or here I had some sort of obvious, you know, poison that got on the bees, it becomes really hard to determine what may have affected the colony in that way. So I would like to think that at a certain point, the large scale beekeeping operations, you know, can make the accommodation to be more natural. The tough part for them is going to be that most of their business is not driven by the production of honey. It's driven by the pollination of big crops like almonds.
Vision of a more regional, more diverse, more prosperous, more fun food system, which is the kind of green, that's the kind of Greenhorns question. What is the role and scale of mead making in that system, and what is the logic that you see expressed in all of these new mead businesses? I guess just to make sure there's a template to the question, like, where's the honey coming from that these small mead companies are coming from, and how are they, what is the cost differential for a more regional honey or a more chemical-free honey versus commodity honey?
There is a straight up difference on the price per pound that they pay, but most of these companies that are developing, again, are developing around the concept of a local product and a product that they want to be able to promote being from the area. So a lot of regional beekeepers will sell to smaller meaderies. In British Columbia, where I live right now, the rules are slightly different. You actually have to own a minimum of 50 hives of bees in order to get a license to make mead. I'm not a huge fan of that kind of regulation, because the intent is that the idea that the BC government has is that will give producers of honey another avenue for value add. But in Michigan, you can buy honey on the open market from anyone you want to, as long as you have a winemaking license, and produce mead with it. So in the context of those states that don't require, or those places that don't require any bees to be kept, what I've noticed is that the people that get into that business want to support their local farmers and want to have a connection with their local beekeepers. And that's one of the key aspects of their business. So you got to be hooked up with the right people that can provide your product, and that is one of the ways that you can do that. Find a good local supplier, and that is generally what has been done. There's not a big commercial push right now. You don't see AB InBev or Miller SAB, you know, making a mead. When you do, that will probably be made with some sort of doctored,
gnarly
imported
Chinese syrup,
Chinese or Malaysian honey. And you know, that gets into the whole aspect of honey laundering, which is a great term. But again, living here in Canada, the transshipment thing is real. honey is a commodity.
Wait a minute. Let's talk about this. What do you mean the transshipment thing is real?
So
people ship honey to Canada and then repack it as Canadian honey?
Absolutely. Sometimes
and
the honey will
honey,
make
probably.
Sorry?
And probably not just honey.
Probably not just honey, but honey is one of the things that has, you know, that has been identified. And transshipment from, well, generally where it comes from is Asia, and most people will peg China as the culprit. But it's, you know, Malaysia is another one, Vietnam is another. And so what will happen is Chinese honey may move through Vietnam and then down into Australia and then up into Canada before it comes to the United States. And at that point, it could maybe be Australian honey, it could maybe be Canadian honey, it could basically be honey that doesn't have import duty on it from specifically China. So what it is it's a shell game that's played around the import duties. And that's, you know, I don't know how they're going to stop that because there's money to be made in it. And there's a market, there's a clear market in the U.S. for more honey. But there, what the government intent here is with the import duties is to try to protect the producers in the U.S. And what they're really protecting there is they feel like they're protecting that commodity market. When most beekeepers would tell you they'd much rather sell regionally because they make a lot more money that way. But
well,
at the end of the day,
let's talk a little bit about the commodity versus regional dollars.
Mm-hmm. So, from a commodity perspective, and this is what happens. If you have a successful year and you have, let's say, 2,000 hives and you've got 100 barrels of honey to sell, if you have a really good program, you know, a little farm market, some decent distribution regionally, a few people that use your products in various bakeries, et cetera, restaurants, you know, you may be able to move a third of that into your regional market. Then that leaves you with another 60 barrels of honey that basically go onto the truck, and you get paid for those all at once. And that's pretty nice from a business perspective. You don't have to hold the product as inventory. You don't have to do the marketing. You don't have to do
it's
the extra
kind of
packaging.
Like shipping cattle.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk about the kind of price range for those?
So when you're doing a bulk honey on any, let's just say like maybe a three-year average here, you're talking about $2 per pound for that honey. So you can look at the little bear at the farmer market that costs $4.50 or $5 and is 12 ounces and see, oh, wow, you can make a lot more money. You can make twice as much money selling this bear at the farmer market, and you can. The issue is you just can't sell everything through that channel. And to have the size operation that you need just from a standalone apiary business, you're going to end up having to sell some of that wholesale. If you have a business where bees are part of the business, you're much more likely to be able to capture that high margin. But when you get into the size of a 2,000 hive apiary, you will need to be selling wholesale. It's
a threshold in terms of full-time apiary.
Yeah, and you know, there are the big ones are 10,000 plus hives, and mostly what they're doing all the time is just building more bees. They don't make a lot of honey just because they spend a lot of time trying to make bees. But it is, you know, it is a line where you can be a small operation. Work regionally with, 150 or 200 hives and have some other products that you're working with, make that part of your mix and be successful. But then it's like anything. Once you grow to a certain size, you don't just switch from one to the other. Then there's a whole other infrastructure that you need to implement in order to do that scale of business. So when you start getting, you know, close to 800 or 1,000 hives of bees, it just becomes a much bigger operation.
Well, I have one more kind of grounding question before we get into our concluding remarks. I've just learned how many coffee beans it takes to make a cup of coffee. And it's, I think, 18 grams. And I met a nice coffee man measured it out for me and showed it to me, and I put it in my hands. And, you know, each of those coffee beans is picked by hand. And it's an incredible amount of work that goes into a cup of coffee, which is so incredibly cheap relative to the work that went in by smallholders and shippers and sorters and fermenters and everybody, most of whom are paid very little. But bees are paid nothing at all. And I wanted to know if you knew, doesn't it take something like 10,000 visits to a flower? Can you tell me how many, can you tell us more about how honey is made and what it takes?
Yeah. It's tricky. It depends on how sweet the flower is and what they're visiting. But typically, you've got close to 50,000 bees that live in a hive together. And on a good summer with good rain, bees are very susceptible to drought because they need to eat nectar and pollen, and that all comes from flowers. So if you got good weather and you have 50,000 bees working all summer, let's say, for about the span of a normal worker's life of 90 to 120 days, those 50,000 bees could produce 50, maybe even 80 pounds of honey if they're in a very productive area. The bees are happy to do it. And when you harvest the honey from the hives, you'd have to replace that with some other food. And sugar water is much cheaper than honey is. So typically in a big commercial operation, after the honey extraction happens, some of the honey gets left in the hive, but then there's supplemental feeding. Sometimes you'll see a clear jar on top of a beehive, and that's basically sugar water that the bees are happy to eat. The bees are like people. They don't go any further than they have to. They're not particularly picky. There was a great, but a very interesting article in the New York Times. This is probably 4 or 5 years ago now, where there was a maraschino cherry finishing business in Brooklyn, and some local bees that were on top of some urban beekeepers had some bees on top of a building about a mile away, and they were completely freaked out when they pulled out they pulled the honey out of the hive, and the whole frame was red, blood red. And it wasn't filled with golden, beautiful honey. It was blood red, and they poked it open, and it was this gooey red syrup. And so, of course, they figured out that what the bees were doing is the bees were flying down to the maraschino cherry finishing plant, sucking up the red dye number 5 and the sugar slurry, flying right back and packing it away for later use. It was very surprising. Oh, this is horrible for the bees. And it made me chuckle a little bit because the bees have a lot more work to do when they convert the nectar and the pollen into honey. That's a natural process that happens with them. But they can eat straight sugars or invert sugars pretty much directly. So I remember somebody saying, oh, this is terrible. And I said, I don't know, if I was a bee, I'd think I had it easy. Like today, you know, I just have to go. Granted, it's like fast food, but it didn't hurt the bees. And bees are opportunists.
Well, so there's a whole lot of philosophical implications in what we're saying here. And, you know, John Smith and John Ruskin would probably have disagreement around the motivation of the bee and duty and honor and power and the theory of humanity. But let's wrap it up without getting into the controversies of our of how we understand the society of bees. What kind of services do you offer, and where else do you recommend young entrepreneurs go?
Well, you had mentioned it earlier, and in most places you can find a retired executive network. SCORE is one that is pretty active, and I would recommend looking at that. You know, when you're thinking about reading, and you know, I have always been more interested in social theory, so I like Durkheim, and I like to read him mainly because it gives me insight into how people think. And you know, really, when it comes to agriculture, it is the future of our planet. It's the way that we're going to feed each other and feed ourselves. So I think that knowing something about social history and social relations is really important in agriculture. And business experience and education as well. You can cover up a lot of business issues by being a good farmer. And so I think it's always important that to check yourself and your own personal development and look at what it is, you know, what it is that you really feel like you need more help with, and either take it upon yourself. A lot of times we don't have the time to take it upon ourselves, but to find those people, and you can find them within your networks, within your social networks, within your professional networks. I would encourage everyone. You may not know it at the time, and I talk a lot and I work with people on mentoring. You may not understand or specifically have said, "Wow, I want you to be my mentor," but it's usually something that happens in hindsight where you feel like, "Wow, I really learned a lot from that person and more than I probably understood at that moment," and that's intrinsic within the individual. People that you're drawn to, the ideas that you want to continue to see develop in the world, that's really where you should be focused, and on your passion. I'm a big believer that the future is going to be a good one for us, and that we have the capacity within ourselves. We've got a lot that has to be sorted out within the ag world and within the sustainability of how we make our food. But I have a really positive view of that. And I feel like we've got another generation. I wouldn't say just a whole generation, but a whole another generation of people that understand that. And we have made those kind of strides in society. And that's one of the main reasons I'm really, really positive and high on agriculture.
Hi on agriculture. Here you are. It's been another episode of Greenhorns Radio, and I will just share a statistic I learned today or yesterday, which is there are more people alive today on Earth than have ever died on Earth. So if anyone ever just happens to say something kind of casual like, "It's always been confusing and strange on planet Earth," you could say, "Maybe so, but I have a new piece of data for you." Yeah. Thank you so much for joining, Nels, and happy summer to you.
Thanks, Severine. I really appreciate it, and good luck out there, everybody. Just stay safe.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Still my love for you.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.